Given the current state of the world, it is a breathtaking proposition to suggest that our deepest human nature is intrinsically one of goodness and being cooperative. Likewise, it would be amazing to think that all the ideals we are confronted with every day of justice, democracy, equality and fairness all have their origins in the highly cooperative social model of our very early ancestors. Moreover, the concepts such as soul, conscience and morality are references to our human, instinctive, genetic orientation towards cooperativeness, fashioned all those millions of years ago. This work of Miller and Griffith, and others like them with respect to ideas like mate selection and the role of nurturing in our past, presents itself as a compelling and interesting alternative to explaining our moral goodness. It stands to seriously challenge the view of Robert Wright, E.O. Wilson, Richard Dawkins, and others that our moral behaviour is nothing more than a subtle form of selfishness, that true or unconditional selflessness or altruism doesn't exist. This emerging view is that in fact it does exist. Having said that, it also leaves us with some confronting philosophical problems. First and foremost being, if as a species we were once gentle, loving and cooperative, then why did we depart from the ideal state and become the extremely competitive, selfish, and aggressive species we are today? Every day in the news, there is evidence of the turmoil of the human situation today. There is conflict between individuals, races, cultures and countries. There is terrorism, starvation, mass displacement of peoples, genocide, environmental devastation, runaway diseases, drug abuse, depression, and epidemic loneliness. Despite all this disharmony, could it be that our oldest and deepest human experience is one of living in a state of sharing, caring, harmonious togetherness? Could it be that our ancient primate forebears were not the red and tooth and claw brutes, ruthlessly competing against one another for survival, as has often been asserted? In fact, could it be that intrinsically we humans are morally good creatures, predisposed in favour of selflessness and cooperation? This is the second of a four-part series on the human condition. This part deals with the subject of soul and the question of the existence of moral instincts in humans. We want to set out to explore morality. What does morality mean? Where does it come from? How long have humans possessed it? Time-honored questions for the philosopher, the scientist, the theologian, and layperson alike have included: what is the origin of our capacity for love, care, and sensitivity towards others? Is this some divine dimension in us conferred on us by a transcendent, overseeing God? Alternatively, are our moral values something that we have created for ourselves during our cultural development? Or could a capacity for goodness be part of our very nature, in fact part of our genetic makeup? Could it be that we actually have genes or instincts that give us a sense of morality, and that this capacity calls on us to behave in accord with it? Every day, in every facet of human life, we are surrounded by concepts of moral value and virtue. We are confronted from the world around us and from within ourselves with concepts of what is morally right and wrong. Individually and collectively, there is this set of morals or ideals by which we variously feel we should attempt to live our life The virtue of doing so is extolled. We variously aspire to live our life in accord with these ideals. Generally speaking, from the youngest age, we are taught in many different ways the simple religious proverb, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." If we look at the vast array of cultures around the world, each have mythologies, stories, codes, rituals and ceremonies that contain dimensions of moral guidance. The focus of the teachings of the great religions of the world is on morality. In Christianity, for example, there are the Ten Commandments. In more recent times, nations have written constitutions that are constructed around the simplest of moral values, such as everyone is born equal. Systems of justice and law have been established seeking to protect against discrimination, inequality, physical, and other harm of persons and their property by others. There is the governmental process of democracy. There are charitable organisations and government support and welfare. These are some of the institutions we have created that find their core objectives as being morally oriented. Is it possible that these systems of thought and their institutions are expressions of an innate inner dimension to our nature? Could they be an expression of our instinctual or genetic makeup that has its origins in millennia past? Before exploring further how we might explain the biological origins of our human morality, it makes sense to put forward a definition of what is meant by morality. Moral virtues or values include the concepts of love, care, self-sacrifice, cooperation, fairness, honesty, trustworthiness, altruism, charity, kindness and empathy. More specifically, morality can be described as a sense that our behaviour is good and right when we are behaving with kindness, fairness and honesty towards other humans, and a sense that we are being bad when we are acting against these values. What this program will explore is the possibility that humans do have an innate moral conscience that acts as an inner, intuitive guide in our decision-making. After all, how could we have an inner sense of guilt and recrimination about unkind, non-ideal behaviour unless some deeper intrinsic part of us felt at odds with such behaviour? Surely this must be evidence that there is something within us that is opposing and calling us to account for such behaviour. If we do have a born with, innate sense of morality, then what are the biological origins of it? How could we have acquired such an aligning, sometimes accusing, voice? Through the ages, humans have sought to give some account for the origin of this moral side of ourselves. The oldest account has been that this capacity comes from outside of ourselves, from a divine source, a transcendent, overseeing God. More recently, over the last 3,000 years, a belief has developed that through the process of reasoning and logic, all aspects of human behaviour, even the deepest, can be explained and comprehended in a rational way. This reason-based account has argued that morality and ethics is an intellectual human construct that has evolved culturally and socially with modern man. These two means of accounting for morality have been described respectively as transcendent and empirical. However, there is new work in science that is suggesting there is a third option. This work advances the view that there is a biological explanation, origin, and basis for our morality. Moreover, that our morality has its origins in our genes, that it is instinctive. To properly understand this line of argument, we need to first look at how science has approached the issue of genetic selection and our own biological evolution. There is little doubt that science took one of its biggest steps forward with Charles Darwin's theory of evolution and natural selection, principally put forward in his 1859 book, The Origins of Species. Darwin's work was the platform for social Darwinists to actively foster the notion of all life operating in a framework of survival of the fittest, competing to exist, with a genetic imperative to reproduce. The following extract from part two of a 2001 documentary titled Testing God, Darwin and the Divine takes up this discussion about the evolution of human behaviour.
Before long, evolution was no longer seriously challenged as the basic explanation of our existence. The motor of this process was seen as the gene's simple and selfish determination to survive. But there was a problem. How could a selfish motor produce beauty, unselfishness, and the sheer complexity of human behaviour?
There's something that I remember, it's a very trivial story, but I was in a tram, and Jews weren't allowed to sit down, they had to stand up outside, etc. And I saw the mother of a schoolmate of mine. I'm going now back to the school where we're still mixed Aryans and Jews. And she saw me and got up. She was sitting. She got up and stood next to me. Never said anything, but it was a silent gesture of, I don't agree with this. I mean, it was all the things that I have lived through and seen. This is something that stuck in my mind. So it must have been an important message to me at the time, that not everybody is on the side of the Nazis.
This was the real dilemma at the heart of evolution. If the problem with God was the existence of evil, the problem with the selfish gene was the existence of good. In the Bronx district of New York, this paradox is clear. Amid poverty and deprivation, goodness clearly survives. People were willing to acknowledge evolution, but not its apparent corollary, that unselfishness was just a distortion of our true selfish nature.
The Gospel of John says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? Nazareth is very much like the South Bronx. They're both poor communities full of outcasts, people who aren't treated very well by society, and the rest of society looks at the South Bronx and says, can anything good come out of the South Bronx? Well, yes, a heck of a lot of good can come out of the South Bronx. Experience tells me that basically human beings are good at the outset, and children, when they're dropped from heaven, are good. It's just the sophistry of the world that messes them up, that makes people feel that it's totally acceptable to step on other people in order to get themselves ahead.
So the good side of human nature became a problem for evolutionists. If they wanted people to understand that they were not the product of God's design, they had to explain how a species driven only by the need to survive could create notions of morality.
That extract from the Testing God documentary makes clear the seemingly irreconcilable problem that biology ended up confronting itself with, namely, how does the selfish gene, survival of the fittest theory, reconcile with evidence of good in humans, with our capacity for emotions such as love, care and charity? In the turmoil of the human situation, there are acts of human goodness. How does biology explain this? And it poses the question of how could a selfish motor create a sense of caring, selfless morality in us? It rightly suggests that biology must one day be able to explain this anomaly, and has begun to try to do just that. Some 10 years ago, a new school of thought emerged in biology that claimed to take account of this problem. In 1994, the American biological theorist Robert Wright's book, The Moral Animal, Why We Are the Way We Are, The New Science of Evolutionary Psychology, was published. As the title suggests, this book, which the New York Times Book Review named as one of the 12 best books of 1994, seeks to explain the biological origins of human morality. In 1998, the renowned Harvard biologist Edward O. Wilson's book, Consilience, The Unity of Knowledge, was published. In it, Wilson developed upon Wright's thesis about the origins of our morality. An extract from this book, titled The Biological Basis of Morality, was introduced as follows. Philosophers and theologians have almost always conceived of moral instincts as being transcendent or God-given. Is it possible, though, that ethical reasoning derives not from outside, but from our very nature as evolving material creatures? Significantly, this new field of evolutionary psychology acknowledged that humans do indeed have moral instincts, that traits for selflessness, kindness, and cooperative behaviour are embedded in our human genetic makeup. Further, the work acknowledged that selflessness was a product of our biological evolution. Significantly, while biological theorists like Wright and Wilson acknowledge that humans have cooperative instincts, they claim that these cooperative instincts derive from biological situations of either reciprocity or kin selection. The situations of reciprocity being referred to are those where animals cooperate for mutual benefit. If you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And the situations of kin selection are where individuals care for others who are related to them in order to ensure the reproduction of their own genes that their relatives share. What Wright and Wilson are doing is attributing a cooperative inclination in humans, our moral instincts, to subtle forms of selfishness, because that is what reciprocity and kin selection are. The selflessness is not unconditional, altruistic selflessness, because the genes are selfishly ensuring their own reproduction. I'll look after you, but only on the condition that you look after me. Wright and Wilson are saying that any acts of selflessness by humans are, from our genes' point of view, actually acts of selfishness. In so doing, they remove the problem of how the apparently selfish motor of genetic evolution produced what we understand to be our selfless morality. This thinking argues that humans don't have truly moral, unconditionally selfless, altruistic instincts. Wright and Wilson are proposing that humans' good can be accounted for under the umbrella of selfishness. They are dismissing our moral instincts, in fact our soul, as merely a refined form of selfishness. This proposition that humans don't fundamentally have a capacity for altruism has been protested vigorously by some who believe such ideas undermine human commitment to morality as an ideal. For example, Randolph Ness, professor of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Michigan, has said, "The discovery that tendencies to altruism are shaped by benefits to genes is one of the most disturbing in the history of science, because understanding this discovery can undermine commitment to morality. It seems silly to restrain oneself if moral behaviour is just another strategy for advancing the interests of one's genes. But if Wright and Wilson are not on the right track, then what other alternatives are being offered by biology? A very different and in many ways exciting new account of our human nature is actually emerging, as the work of the following two scientists from opposite sides of the globe shows. Both these researchers present a biological explanation of human morality and goodness that doesn't portray our morality as a subtle form of selfishness. Their thinking argues that humans do have unconditionally selfless, genuinely altruistic instincts. Geoffrey Miller, Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for Economic Learning and Social Evolution at the University College London, is a young scientist who is challenging much of the conventional wisdom about the origins of morality. Author of The Mating Mind, How Sexual Choice Shaped the Evolution of Human Nature, which was published in 2001, Miller is one of a new breed of evolutionary psychologists. The following is another extract from the 2001 documentary, Testing God, Darwin and the Divine.
I think the way in which human nature got oversimplified was this phrase, survival of the fittest, was viewed as the only legitimate explanation for human nature. So everything that was of interest, you had to find a, quote, survival value for it. For many of the most interesting aspects of human nature, like consciousness or poetic language or sense of humor or the moral virtues, it's very hard to find survival payoffs for those things.
I don't think we can possibly afford to ignore the good side of people, because that's basically what the truth is. And we get carried away with theories based on incidents and a few statistics, and they're a very superficial factual analysis. The real truth is the goodness in the hearts of people, especially the hearts of these children, of mothers, who will go out and save somebody who's homeless and drunk and addicted, who's in trouble out on the street, simply because, in their words, I'm a mother too. That kind of relationship to another human being on the basis of nothing more than their humanity and their basic goodness one to another is far more truthful than a bunch of numbers.
And the more we unraveled the constituent elements of our genetic makeup, the more puzzling became the very things we valued about ourselves. With God, it was simple. The nature we'd been given had goodness and altruism within it. But selfish genes, what could they give us but selfishness?
It was fashionable to take a sort of evolutionary reductionist view that said there really isn't any such thing as genuine altruism. Mm-hmm. What that was reflecting was the relatively simple state of evolutionary theory at the time. At the time, basically, the way that you explain kindness was either people are kind to their genetic relatives with whom they share genes, so they're really promoting copies of the same genes. So that's why parents are kind to kids and why you're kind to your nieces and nephews as well. Or you have sort of short-term trading relationships, reciprocity relationships, and you can explain those. And everything else tended to be pigeonholed into one of those two categories. Either it's nepotism or it's short-term reciprocity. There was a tendency to say everything sort of kind and gentle and spiritual about human nature is a sort of facade, is a sort of gloss on selfish genes that are ticking away underneath.
I think it's the exact opposite. I think selfie, nasty, and brutish is learned behavior.
I think it's actually more scientific to say altruism is real, kindness is real, romantic love is real, how do we explain it? Rather than to sort of sweep it under the carpet and say, oh, that's just culture.
This line of thinking by Miller has common ground with the work of Australian biologist Jeremy Griffith. Author of a number of books about the biology of human nature, Griffith is director of the Foundation for Humanities Adulthood, an independent organisation established to specifically investigate the the biology of the human condition, human's capacity for good and evil. While Griffith agrees with Wright and Wilson that cooperative behaviour is in our instincts, he strongly disagrees with their explanation for it. Like Miller, Griffith argues that humans have genuinely altruistic moral instincts, that our moral instincts are not just a facade for selfishness, as Wright and Wilson would have us believe.
I think it was a significant step for biology when biological theorists like Wright and Wilson acknowledged that we humans do have inclinations towards goodness and morality embedded in our genes. But to say that that sense of goodness and morality is nothing more than a subtle form of selfishness, is selfish selflessness, is, I think, quite disturbing. In fact, I would say it's an act of evasion and denial of everything that we intuitively know about ourselves as human beings. What they've done, I believe, is deliberately try to find a way to hide the existence of genuinely altruistic instincts in humans because of the confronting implications that flow from such an acceptance. I mean, to accept that we have selfless, loving and cooperative instincts begs the question, well, why do humans behave in the opposite way now, namely selfishly, aggressively and competitively? It leaves us confronted with a dilemma of the human condition, the question of our corrupted state. But there comes a time in the human journey when we need to be honest and confront the truth about ourselves, because only by doing that can we put ourselves in a position to find understanding of ourselves. I mean, you can't find the truth from a position of lying, or more precisely, psychological denial. I believe that biology can provide an explanation for the origins of our morality that is consistent with what we know about ourselves, an explanation that accounts for our genuinely loving, cooperative, unconditionally selfless, altruistic instincts. I also believe there's a very sound biological reason why humans haven't been able to behave ideally since this early time in our primate past.
Parts 3 and 4 of this documentary series will look at this question of why humans departed from the utterly selfless, fully cooperative, ideal state. So, Miller and Griffith find common ground in believing that Wright and Wilson have not yet arrived at the full picture about ourselves. The work of Miller and Griffith also has an overlap in their explanations for the origins of our altruistic moral capacity. Firstly, to look at Miller's explanation for our moral instincts. Again, we return to an extract from the Testing God documentary.
Jeffrey Miller is one of a new breed of evolutionary psychologists who are trying to show that evolution need not view the good side of us as something outside biology.
Jeffrey?
Yeah?
Miller's argument is that the survival of the fittest is only part of our evolutionary story. Our ultimate raison d'etre is to reproduce. So it's not just natural selection between predator and its prey that shapes us, but sexual selection as well.
We think survival of the fittest couldn't go the whole distance in accounting for human nature. And we think there must have been something else to fill that gap. And I'm saying sexual selection is what fills the gap, because it's capable of noticing anything that we can even talk about. If I notice that somebody else has a rich consciousness and I sort of wonder, why do they have that? My capacity for noticing that contains the answer. It says, I notice that, that might influence the sexual choice I make with regard to that person. It might make them more attractive to me. And just by admitting that, you're saying that's subject to sexual selection. We have this amazing window into the minds and souls of other people that other animals don't, because we have language, because we have rich social lives. And that means sexual selection has the power to reach into these moral virtues and these spiritual interests and to shape them in a way that it couldn't do in any other species.
According to Miller, this is the crucible of human evolution. The sexual tension between men and women is what has driven our evolution and shaped our natures.
When I think about how sexual attraction might have worked among our ancestors as they were sort of going through the final spurt on the way to becoming modern Homo sapiens, I tend to think of them as conspicuously displaying their capacities for sympathy and kindness. So anything that would have been sexually attractive would have been subject to sexual choice. Sexual choice could have amplified these traits, made them more elaborate, more conspicuous, more easily displayed. It is an argument for runaway kindness in the same way that runaway sexual selection can explain the size of the peacock's tail. In our species, it explains the size of our hearts and our capacity for romantic commitment. And I think the sort of intricacy and depth of our consciousness as well.
Griffith agrees with Miller that mate or sexual selection played a critical role in giving humans altruistic instincts. However, he believes that mate selection is only part of the story. Griffith's view is that nurturing of infants also played a crucial role. He points out that most animals have to look after their offspring if their offspring are to survive, and he says that it is this maternalism that has had the potential to train offspring in unconditionally selfless, altruistic behaviour, and thus produce an instinctive orientation towards such behaviour.
Most species of animals have to nurture their offspring, give them food and shelter, otherwise their offspring die. Maternal instincts ensure the continuation of a species. What's interesting about maternal instincts or traits is that to an observer they appear to be selfless while actually being selfish. The mother appears to be giving her offspring everything for nothing in return. She's giving them nourishment, shelter, warmth and protection, but receiving no apparent reward for herself for doing this. However, while maternalism looks like it is selfless behaviour, the truth is that because the offspring carry the mother's genes, by selflessly fostering her offspring, the mother's maternal genetic traits are actually selfishly ensuring their own reproduction. I mean, maternalism is a form of kin selection. So while maternal traits appear to be selfless, they are in fact selfish, which genetic traits normally have to be if they are to reproduce and carry on in a species. An unconditionally selfless trait, such as to give your life for others, normally can't become established in a species because being self-sacrificing, the trait doesn't tend to carry on. The fact is maternal traits are selfishly fostering their own reproduction in the offspring, but they nevertheless do appear to be selfless. The offspring appears to be being given everything for nothing in return. It's this appearance of maternalism as being selfless behaviour that is, I believe, so significant. It's significant because from the offspring's point of view, from its viewing brain's point of view, it believes it's being constantly treated in an unconditionally selfless way. Even though the maternal treatment is actually genetically selfish, the offspring only sees and experiences treatment as being selfless. Now, what this means is that all day long, while it is being nurtured, the offspring is being taught that the way you should treat others is selflessly. That's the offspring's experience of life, basically to love one another. The point is that while maternalism is genetically selfish, it trains the developing minds of infants to be selflessly behaved. What this means is that an opportunity exists in maternalism to train infants to behave selflessly towards others and thus to grow up and treat others in a selfless way.
Griffith believes that nurturing was a way for animal societies to become as cooperative as ant and bee societies are, or the cells and body parts of multicellular organisms are.
I think this device for nurturing cooperative behaviour is so effective that it is a way for animal species to become as cooperative as ants are or as the cells in our body are. If I pull out a hair from my head and throw it away, my body carries on. The hair gave its life for my body. All the parts of my body have subordinated their individuality to the good of the greater whole. Our body and ant colonies became totally cooperative, fully integrated wholes or units or collectives or colonies or societies by elaborating the reproductive unit. The individual ants or individual cells in our body deferred their sexual reproduction so that the colony or body is only one sexual individual. Deferring their own sexual reproduction eliminated the divisive competition amongst the individual Ansell cells to reproduce. Their reproduction is ensured through their support of the sexual queen in the case of ants, or the sexual parts of our body in the case of our body cells. The problem for large animals is they can't employ this device of elaborating the reproductive unit for developing a fully cooperative integrated colony, because it means too great a loss of variability. For example, if you had one reproducing queen zebra and 10 sacrificial non-reproducing offspring dedicated to protecting her, and this became a common practice among zebras, then the genetic variety of the population of a population of, say, 1,000 zebras would be reduced to only 100. And I mean, this is a drastic drop in variability, and species need genetic variability for adapting to change. Ant colonies are only small in relation to their environment, and so ants have developed a colonial way of living without any significant loss of variability. But for large animal species, developing colonies by elaborating the reproductive unit is not a viable option. Large animals had to find another way to form fully cooperative colonies or societies, and I'm saying that nurturing was the means by which they could do that. So in terms of what was explained earlier in part one of this documentary series about the meaning of existence being to develop the order of matter on Earth due to the influence of negative entropy, animals that were small in relation to their environment were able to become integrated by elaborating the reproductive unit, while large animals had to employ nurturing.
While nurturing, Griffith believes, can develop unconditionally selfless behaviour in large animal species, he points out that few species could afford to leave their infants in infancy for very long, and thus be able to develop this means for training infants in selflessness.
The difficulty for most large animal species in developing this nurturing opportunity to train infants in selflessness is that they can't afford to leave their infants in infancy for very long, and thus develop much training in selflessness. For most species, their infants are too helpless and weak, and thus vulnerable to predators and other dangers, to be left in infancy for very long. A zebra foal, for example, has to be up on its feet and largely out of the vulnerable, totally dependent infant state within minutes if it is to survive. It turns out, I believe, that only the primates were sufficiently preconditioned to develop nurturing to the level where selfless training could be fully developed. Because of their tree-living lifestyle, primates were already semi-upright from having to swing through the branches. This is significant because being semi-upright meant their arms were relatively free and available to hold and look after the helpless infant. It was this freedom of arms to hold and carry infants that was crucial, and why it was amongst primates that the ability to develop nurturing and thus training an altruistic, unconditionally selfless behaviour was able to be developed. Incidentally, this need for arms to be free from walking to enable nurturing of selflessness means that upright walking must have occurred earlier in our primate past. Indeed, studies of recent fossil discoveries are showing that upright walking came early in our primate past, not late in it, as had previously been postulated by many anthropologists.
Griffith believes that it was this nurturing opportunity to develop training in selflessness that was taken up in our particular primate ancestor. The result, he says, is that our primate ancestor became instinctively oriented to behaving in an unconditionally selfless, altruistic, and thus totally cooperative way. Most species can only develop a degree of cooperation because they have to be, to some degree, selfish. They have to compete with each other for food, shelter, space, and a mate. If everyone is only looking out for themselves, then there can be little cooperation and thus unity. Put simply, selfishness is divisive and disintegrative, while selflessness is unifying and integrative. In summary, Griffith maintains that our ape ancestor wasn't brutish and aggressive, as is often being claimed, but gentle, selfless, loving and cooperative. He believes the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau's idea of the noble savage was right. In Rousseau's 1755 book, the social contract. He wrote that nothing is more gentle than man in his primitive state.
What I'm suggesting is that it is nurturing that made us human, that gave us our instinctive orientation to behaving kindly and selflessly towards others. In fact, that gave us a gentle, loving, instinctive self or soul with its ideal behaviour demanding conscience. I'm proposing that there truly is a biological base for our long recognised soul and its voice within us, namely our conscience. What happened is that this training in selflessness eventually became instinctive behaviour in our forebears. Once the nurtured training in selflessness was developed to the point where it was recurring generation after generation, then gradually natural selection would make the behaviour instinctive. Genes, as it were, follow and reinforce any behaviour, making it instinctive, as long as the behaviour continually occurs. For example, when our conscious mind takes us in a direction of its own choosing, such as in this development of high technology today, which has led to such a much speeded up and thus stressful world, then gradually there will naturally be occurring adaptation of our species to stress. Individuals that happen to have a genetic makeup that copes with stress will survive better. Genes will always naturally follow and reinforce any development process. In this, genes are not selective. The difficulty was in getting the development of unconditional selflessness to occur, for once it was occurring, it would naturally become instinctive over time. The problem prior to this nurturing opportunity to develop cooperative individuals was that only selfish behaviour was occurring. There was no unconditional selflessness reoccurring to become instinctively reinforced. So I maintain that Rousseau's idea of the noble savage, of an instinctive time in our past when we live cooperatively in a state that was free of, or if you like, innocent of selfishness, competition and aggression, was right. All the great mythologies of the world, in fact, recognise a golden age, a time when humans lived in a harmonious, sharing, gentle, trouble-free, cooperative state. In Christian mythology, for example, there's the Garden of Eden state of innocence that humans are supposed to have lived in. Hesiod, the 8th century BC Greek poet, wrote in his poem Theogony, "When gods alike and mortals rose to birth, a golden race the immortals formed on earth. Like gods they lived with calm untroubled mind. Strangers to ill, their lives in feasts flowed by. Theirs was each good, the life-sustaining soil, yielded its copious fruits, unbridled by toil. They with abundant goods, midst quiet lands, all willing shared the gathering of their hands." And William Wordsworth, of course, wrote evocatively in his wonderful poem, Intimations of Immortality, that trailing clouds of glory do we come.
The obvious question occurs, if we were once, in our primitive past, gentle and cooperative, why did we depart from that innocent, pure, ideal state and become the highly competitive, selfish and aggressive species we are today? What is the biological reason for our non-ideal state? In religious terms, what was the reason for the fall? What is the origin of sin? What caused us to be thrown out of the Garden of Eden? This question and related questions, like why is nurturing so difficult for humans today, will be addressed in part 3 of this series, titled The Question of the Emergence of Consciousness and the Human Condition, and in part 4 titled The Question of How to Reconcile and Ameliorate Our Alienated Condition. To complete this second part of the series, The Question of the Existence of Moral Instincts in Humans, we have yet to hear Griffith's account of the part he sees mate selection as playing in this idea of nurturing, giving humans an instinctive orientation to behaving cooperatively.
To explain the role of mate selection in this nurturing process, we have to look more closely at what was going on. If we think about it, there's a problem with developing training in selflessness through nurturing. At a certain point, selflessness begins to defeat itself. While nurturing of infants is strongly encouraged genetically because it ensures greater infant survival. The side effect of training infants to behave selflessly as adults is that the selflessly behaving and even self-sacrificing adults don't tend to reproduce their genes as much as selfishly behaving adults. The genes of exceptionally maternal mothers don't tend to endure because their offspring tend to be too selflessly behaved, too ready to put others before themselves. More aggressive and competitive individuals take advantage of their selflessness. In particular, they take any mating opportunities for themselves. I mean, it's that old joke, the meek will inherit the earth if that's all right with you blokes. In other words, you've got fat chance of that happening, mate, while we tough men are around. Clearly, while substantial unconditional selflessness is able to be developed through nurturing due to the greater initial survival of infants who have been well cared for, there was a limit to how much it could be developed genetically. It was this point of limitation that mate selection was able to come to the rescue. Our ape ancestor began to consciously support the development of selflessness. Our forebears began to recognise the importance of selflessness and as a result began to actively select for it. This could be done by consciously seeking out more nurtured, cooperative individuals to mate with. As Jeffrey Miller described it, sexual selection has the power to reach into these moral virtues and to shape them in us.
In his three books, Free, The End of the Human Condition, published in 1988, Beyond the Human Condition, published in 1991, and A Species in Denial, published in 2003, Griffith describes how this sexual selection that accompanied maternal training in selflessness resulted in the physical appearance of humans today.
It makes sense that the more selfless individuals would have been those who had experienced a long infancy, had exceptionally maternal and assertive mothers, and were also closer to their memory of infancy, that is, younger. The older individuals became, the more their infancy training and selflessness wore off, and our ape ancestor began to recognise this. Recognise that the younger an individual, the more selfless and cooperative he or she was likely to be. Our ancestors began to idolise, foster and select youthfulness because of its association with cooperativeness. And the effect over many thousands of generations was to retard our physical development so that we became infant-like or neotenised in our appearance as adults. Neoteny is the retention of juvenile characteristics into adulthood. This explains how we came to regard the neotenous features of large eyes, dome forehead and snub nose and hairless skin as beautiful. The physical effect of this neotenising process was that we lost most of our body hair and became infant-looking compared with our adult ape ancestor. These pictures that are reproduced in my first two books dramatically evidence this. Firstly, these pictures, which originally appear in Stephen Jay Gould's 1981 book, The Mismeasure of Man, show an infant common chimpanzee and below it an adult common chimpanzee, and you can see very clearly how extraordinarily human-like the infant is. This next picture shows the skulls of the ancestors of humans from 4 million years ago to the present. And you can see very clearly the skull shape becoming more and more neotenous or infant-like. Finally, this picture, which is reproduced from Adolf Schultz's 1969 book, The Life of Primates, shows a common chimpanzee fetus at 7 months of age. It shows body hair on the scalp, eyebrows, borders of the eyelids, lips and chin, exactly where we humans retain body hair today. The inference being that we have become neotenised right back to this very early stage in development.
Since nurturing was the prime mover or main influence in the development of humans in Griffith's account, it means this early ape ancestor period would have been matriarchal or female role dominated. But Griffith believes females also played a leading role in mate selection and in the overall containment management of competitive and aggressive behaviour.
Since historically primate males were preoccupied competing for mating opportunities, females must have been the first to select for selflessness by favouring selfless rather than competitive and aggressive mates. And studies are showing this to be the case. In a study of baboons, for example, Shirley Strum records that male newcomers also were generally the most dominant, while long-term residents were the most subordinate, the most easily cowed. Yet, in winning the receptive females and special foods, the subordinate, unaggressive veterans got more than their fair share, the newcomers next to nothing. The unaggressive veterans got more than their fair share. In fact, in pretty much all areas of behaviour, the females would have had to take control of the situation, assert their influence and make sure that aggression and competitiveness, especially male aggression and competition for mating opportunities, didn't break out and regress the situation back to the old, each for himself, divisive, competitive, aggressive, you've got no chance, mate, state.
If what Griffiths is saying is right about our origins, the question arises, why haven't all primates taken the opportunity to develop nurturing to achieve the fully cooperative state?
While freedom of arms from walking was, I suggest, a key factor in developing nurturing, there are other requirements. Ideal nursery conditions would be necessary. If the available food, shelter, space was limited, or other difficulties and threats such as from predators were excessive, then we can expect that there would have occurred a strong inclination to revert back to more selfish and competitive behaviour. In fact, I believe you can grade the various primate species in terms of how cooperative they are by assessing how ideal their environment is for nurturing. The less ideal the conditions for nurturing, the less cooperative the species will be. For example, all the evidence is that the bonobos or pygmy chimpanzees, or Pan paniscus as they're scientifically known, who live in the rainforest south of the Congo or Zaire River, are by far the most cooperative primate species. In fact, I consider that they are a species living on the very threshold of the metaphorical Garden of Eden, golden, utterly cooperative state that I believe we humans once lived in. Interestingly, bonobos were only identified as a species in 1929. In terms of our human origins, for our ape ancestor to have become totally cooperative, as I'm asserting occurred, then necessarily it must have lived in ideal nursery conditions.
To suggest what our evolutionary path has been, Griffith makes an intriguing comparison between the common chimpanzees and bonobos, or pygmy chimpanzees, as they are sometimes called.
Common chimpanzees are found in equatorial Africa, north and east of the Congo or Zaire River. The social model of common chimpanzees is patriarchal or male-dominated. Although there is focus on the young by common chimpanzee mothers, the environment in which they live is often disturbed by males aggressively competing for mating opportunities with the females. Further, the drier and more sparse environment of upland open forests where many of them live, where food is relatively short supply, puts the social bonds under great pressure. It also results in fierce intergroup confrontation. The common chimpanzees also regularly hunt and kill colobus monkeys as a source of protein. The social model of common chimpanzees is very different to that of the bonobos living in their food-rich rainforest world south of the Congo or Zaire River. In the bonobos, there's been a gender reversal in the social dynamic of the group. Bonobo females form alliances and dominate social groups, both male roles in common chimpanzee society. Bonobos are matriarchal, and the entire focus of the social group does seem to be on the maternal or female role of nurturing and caring for infants. The newborns stay in a state of infancy and are totally dependent on their mother for a very long period of time. They are weaned at four, sometimes as late as six, and are carried for another year. Bonobo females have one offspring every 5 years. Also of particular importance is the bond between the mother and the son. The son will maintain his connection with his mother for life and will depend on her for his social standing in the group. The son of the dominant female, who is the strong matriarch, that maintain social order will rise in the ranks of the group. In this way, there is perpetuation of the most cooperative individuals in the group. In their behaviour, bonobos are much gentler than their chimpanzee cousins. In fact, physical violence almost never occurs in bonobos, yet is common in common chimps. While infanticide is not uncommon amongst common chimps, it appears to be non-existent amongst bonobos. In fact, even orphan bonobos are taken care of by the group in bonobo society, something that doesn't happen in common chimp society. Social groups of bonobos are much more stable than social groups of common chimps. Indeed, bonobos can come together in groups of up to 120 individuals. Anthropologist Barbara Frath, who spent 9 years studying bonobos in the wild, says that up to 100 bonobos at a time from several groups spend their night together, and that would not be possible with common chimpanzees because there would be brutal fighting between the rival groups. Bonobos have more slender upper bodies than common chimpanzees. There's less size difference between the sexes. They're more arboreal, have greater tendency to walk upright, and are known to share their food. While common chimps restrict their plant food intake to mainly fruit, bonobos eat leaves and plant pith as well as fruit, a diet more like that of gorillas. While they have been known to capture and eat small game, they're not known to systematically hunt down and eat large animals such as monkeys as common chimps do. In a moment, we'll show you some footage of bonobos from documentaries about them, but before showing that, I'll just show you some still pictures. This is from a book, Bonobos, The Forgotten Ape, by Franz de Waal and Franz Lanting. And it's just got a picture of a bonobo walking upright and called Lana. And it's just very powerful, evocative of humans. And you can see Lana's well-developed breasts. Amongst primates, incidentally, it's only bonobos that have well-developed breasts like humans have. These are three photographs, just giving a snapshot, just a little window into how nurturing these apes are, these extraordinary apes are. That's one showing a mother bouncing a baby on her feet, and another bonobo mother playing ring-a-rosie with her baby. And this is a photo reproduced in my book of a famous couple of bonobos, Matata and her adopted son, Kanzi, which all give you a feeling for just how nurturing they are as a species.
Griffith has assembled extracts from various bonobo documentaries. These documentaries are all recent, made in the 10 years prior to the making of this documentary, which is being made in mid-2004. And the reason they are so recent is because little was known about this very rare and extremely threatened primate until recent times. Griffith maintains that these documentary extracts bear out all that he says about the role of nurturing and mate selection.
The following are descriptions of bonobos from various documentaries. I'm certain none of those involved in the making of these documentaries were aware of this nurturing explanation for primate development, so the comments in the documentaries are completely impartial. I believe what you will hear and see will dramatically evidence all that I've been saying about the nurturing mate selection process. We're looking for evidence of the following: that bonobos live in ideal nursery conditions, a warm climate, an environment which has ample food, and with the safety of the jungle, trees for sleeping, travelling and shelter, that they have few predators, that females are extremely maternal and look after their infants until they are 5 years old, that their societies are matriarchal or female dominated, controlled and led, that male aggression has been tamed. In fact, unlike other great apes, there is little size difference between males and females. That physical violence almost never occurs. What you will see is that even sex has been employed by bonobos as an appeasement tool for subsiding and conflict and tension. you will see that the bonobos are relatively placid, peaceful and egalitarian, exhibiting a remarkable sensitivity to others and live in large, harmonious, stable groups. You will see that they share their food, that they are largely vegetarian and don't hunt other animals like common chimps do. You will see that bonobos often walk upright. In fact, they are by far the most upright walking of the great apes. It's long been claimed that it was the move to savannah and the need to see over tall grass that led to upright walking. But the bonobos live in the jungle, so it must have been some other influence that is selecting for upright walking, and I'm saying that influence was the need to develop nurturing. You will see that in their physical features, bonobos are exceptionally neotenous. If you look at these three photographs reproduced in my book, the first is of an adult common chimpanzee. The second is of a juvenile common chimpanzee. And the third is of an adult bonobo. You can see how much the adult bonobo looks like the infant common chimpanzee. You will see that this neoteny of bonobos is acknowledged in these documentary extracts. You will see that there is a lot of variance in features between individual bonobos, indicating the species is rapidly changing, suggesting the bonobo species has hit upon some opportunity to rapidly develop and thus rapidly change. You will see that the bonobos are extremely intelligent, probably the most intelligent species on Earth after humans. In the next, the third part of this series, an explanation will be given of how nurturing liberated consciousness, that the bonobos have been able to develop such a high degree of nurturing and are also so intelligent, will be evidence of this coming explanation for the origin of consciousness.
We have seen how Geoffrey Miller's belief that the sexual selection for traits such as care and empathy resulted in runaway kindness intersects with the line of argument being put by Jeremy Griffith.
I'm suggesting that in terms of our evolution, our human ancestors lived in a totally cooperative, integrated and loving state. This nurturing development of integration began some 12 million years ago and became fully developed in our primate ancestor some 5 million years ago, before succumbing to the emergence of a very competitive, aggressive and selfish, fully conscious ancestor some 2 million years ago. This period from 12 to 2 million years ago then is, I'm suggesting, what produced our sense of morality and our conscience, our innate sense of right and wrong. This period from 12 to 2 million years ago was our species' time in infancy and childhood, where we lived in a metaphorical Garden of Eden state of integrative cooperativeness.
In support of this proposition that our earliest ancestors were cooperative rather than aggressive and competitive, renowned anthropologist Richard Leakey and writer Roger Lewin in their 1977 book Origins say, "We emphatically reject this conventional wisdom that war and violence are in our genes. The clues that do impinge on the basic elements of human nature argue much more persuasively that we are cooperative rather than an aggressive animal." Given the current state of the world, it is a breathtaking proposition to suggest that our deepest human nature is intrinsically one of goodness and being cooperative. Likewise, it would be amazing to think that all the ideals we are confronted with every day of justice, democracy, equality and fairness all have their origins in the highly cooperative social model of our very early ancestors. Moreover, the concepts such as soul, conscience, and morality are references to our human, instinctive, genetic orientation towards cooperativeness, fashioned all those millions of years ago. This work of Miller and Griffith, and others like them with respect to ideas like mate selection and the role of nurturing in our past, presents itself as a compelling and interesting alternative to explaining our moral goodness. It stands to seriously challenge the view of Robert Wright, E.O. Wilson, Richard Dawkins, and others that our moral behaviour is nothing more than a subtle form of selfishness, that true or unconditional selflessness or altruism doesn't exist. This emerging view is that, in fact, it does exist. Having said that, it also leaves us with some confronting philosophical problems. First and foremost being, if as a species we were once gentle, loving and cooperative, then why did we depart from the ideal state and become the extremely competitive, selfish and aggressive species we are today? As has been mentioned, this issue is part of the subject matter of the final two parts to this four-part series.